so.
The good news and the bad news is that Xamarin is graded. I'll show you the means and the distributions you can back in class. I do encourage you to look over your paper to figure out what went right and wrong. And if you really aren't happy with the grade, I will share with you. Statistically, the grade you make on this test is probably the best predictor for the grade you make on the next test. Individually, that really means nothing. Okay? I've seen people go from pretty low on the distribution to quite reasonably up there, okay? Because physics is one of these things where it can be all knotted up, but if you change something and sort of fix what's not working, so maybe that is you start asking all your questions and getting things straightened out, whereas you used to not really do that. Or maybe you don't really keep a systematic list of the things that aren't quite making sense and then checking in with somebody. Or maybe you don't go over the solutions. And where if you fix one of those things, okay, maybe you start to understand things and begin to gel and you can do quite well. So individually, I think the statement that the current, how you're doing is sort of the best predictor for how you will do, is meaningless, but the one heads up is really nothing changes if nothing changes, okay? So you really have to look over your exam and see how you did. But in doing that, I do want you to check the grading, yes. That includes making sure that the numbers were added up correctly at the end, or were in the score. But the other thing is, if you didn't do as well as you'd like, what you need to do is to understand the problems and the solution set and then ask yourself, why didn't I get that? What is it? When we did a problem in the problem set that actually had this conceptual element in it, or when we did something in the workshop that had that in it, because although I may disguise stuff pretty well, you really won't see anything on the exam you haven't seen before. And so you ask yourself, why did that not stick? And it's through that process that maybe you can find the things that need to change. So that's what I encourage you to do. I know the exam, semester is flying along now. I'm sure some of us will talk about this more as we go. That said, actually, I think the class as a whole did pretty well. So, now, we'll come back to that. In terms of physics, last time we started a topic that I call static equilibrium. Static equilibrium is a physicist's fancy way of saying it's not moving. So it's not translating and it's not rotating. So to say that in mathematical form, the sum of the forces is equal to zero, tells you it's not accelerating. If it's at rest, it stays at rest. The sum of the torques is equal to zero tells you that it's not rotating. If it's at rest, it stays at rest. And in fact, something can rotate and not translate, or translate and not rotate. So it is a necessary condition to have both of these things be true. Now, the sum of the torques, these are vector equations, right? So they're true about any axis. They're true in all three dimensions. It's about any axis in any direction. So they're very powerful. Basically, you can think of these as being equivalent to six different equations. You'll seldom need to work it out more than two, I guess. Usually, these problems will be usually set up in two dimensions, and you'll have to do the sum of the forces, up and down or something like that, up and like vertically and horizontally or something like that, and the torques about one axis. Now, I can choose an arbitrary number of axes, so you can imagine that out of that I could come up with an arbitrary number of equations, which is sort of true, but none of those equations have independent information. If I sum the torques up about a single axis and I get zero, then that is the statement, that is the information that this thing is not rotating. So I cannot then choose another axis and get a different equation.
they'll just be the same information. So it's not an infinite thing. Anyway, that said, that's the theory. So it's actually pretty straightforward in a lot of ways. The trick is looking at the problem and making sure you've got all the forces involved. And there are some times where that's a little bit subtle. So I'll do an example problem today, which is about as subtle as it gets. A lot of it is so just intuitive. If this block is sitting on a not quite flat surface, you can imagine this block being acted on by gravity as if gravity is acting just at the center of gravity, as I pointed there. And there's a normal force, which I drew off to the side just for clarity here, but there's a normal force that's acting upward from the table surface. Those two cancel each other out, which is why the block is just sitting there. We say it's in static equilibrium. In this case, the normal force, I mean, it's acting everywhere along here, but you can also imagine it's just going through the center. I drew it a little bit off to the side here, which maybe actually is a mistake for this part of the class, because now you have to start paying attention to where the forces are, actually. So maybe I will go to the trouble of moving this. No, maybe not. If you now move the block over a little bit, you can ask, where is the block when it begins to tip? And it will begin to tip at the time where you'll have a normal force acting over here, but now you'll have a force of gravity that's acting down, and you'll have a torque. Both of these forces, in fact, gives you a torque that will rotate you like this. So when the block gets to the very point where the center of gravity just creeps over the edge, it'll tip. Which, of course, you know. But that's what happens. And the physics will tell you that. And then the further over it is, the more it tips. So you're not in static equilibrium here, but you could ask questions like, you know, if I put a rod right here, how much weight would it bear in order to be in static equilibrium or something? So a lot of it, I think, is just intuitive. Let me take just a moment and fix. Let me not worry about it. Okay. All right, so what I'd like to do, actually, I mean, that's the theory. That's all there is to it. It's now really just practicing and looking for those, making sure you got the forces and figuring out how to deal with them. So I'd like to do several examples. And here's the first example I want to do, where we have a uniform beam. And when you have a uniform beam, what that means is you can imagine that gravity acts on that beam at the center of gravity or the center of mass. Okay, those are the same thing when you're talking about something at the surface of the Earth, or how gravity acts on it. And because it's a uniform beam, I put the center of gravity at a point which is at the midpoint in terms of the length of the beam, and or the center of mass, and that's where gravity will act. Then this thing has two supports. We're given that support number one is 2 meters from one edge of the beam, and that it supports a weight of 39.2 newtons. The mass of the beam itself is 12 kilograms, and its full length is 10 meters. And then you're given that the beam is in static equilibrium. So that means the equations we just had are true, and that's what you'll use to solve the problem. And then the questions are, where is support 2? So that is, where is it located along here? What is the distance x here? And how much weight does it support? So if you just look at this for a moment, and I'll tell you that the mass of this thing, since its mass is 12 kilograms, it's 12 kilograms times 9.8, which I actually did calculate. It's about 117.6 newtons total. So if this total beam is 117 newtons, and I tell you that this beam, this support,
supports almost 40 visions of that. What is your gut instinct about roughly where this support will have to go? Carrying a rug over your shoulders, right? And somebody gets over at one end and leaves you the rest. Are you going to be carrying a heavier weight or a lighter weight? It's going to be a lot heavier. And you're going to have to move somewhere over here in order to support all that, right? So I hope that actually feels intuitive to you. Because in a lot of this, that intuition is sort of handy. That said, be very cautious, because you want to be very systematic in doing these problems. It's okay to have some intuition to begin with, but it is true that sometimes things move in ways that your intuition is wrong. So you want to then do the formal analysis and then re-examine your intuition, especially if it gave you something you weren't expecting. Okay. The rug actually reminded me of, I don't know whether it's a funny or horrible story. It is a horrible story. But it truly struck me as funny. So I went to Columbia, University of Manhattan, to graduate school. And I was sitting in my apartment one day, and there was a big banging on the door, and I opened it up, and there's this like Made for Television cop standing there. Pulls open his badge and said, I'd like to ask you a few questions. I'm like, holy crap. I didn't have that much fun last night. I don't know what you want. And so he was very simple. He just asked me if I'd seen a rug rolled up outside the building where I lived. And that's not uncommon at all there, because when people get tired of furniture in Manhattan, they just sort of throw it on the street. And then the next people would come along, look at it, and go, hey, cool rug, or cool TV, and they take it in. And it's sort of a standard procedure there, especially when you have students coming and going. And so, I didn't notice it, because there's always crap down there. I said, so what's this about? Because I'm not willing to tell them. Okay. And so the next morning, I opened up the Columbia, whatever it's called, the student newspaper, and there's the story. This was 2 weeks into the semester. 7 undergraduate freshmen had gone downtown drinking. And on their way back, they came out of the subway, and they're walking back to their dorm, and they see this rug on the street by my building, and picked it up to take it to their suite to use the rug. And they unrolled it, and there's a dead body inside with 2 bullet holes in their head. Is that horrible? I mean, they've got to be wounded for life. And I read this story, and I started laughing so hard, because I could just imagine they're all thinking those other assholes weren't holding their share of the rug or whatever. I mean, it had to be really heavy, right? And they're all drunk, and they just... And then the phone calls to Mom, right? Hi, Mom, guess what happened? 2 weeks into the semester. Oh, God. So, I'm sorry. I couldn't help but laugh, but it is a horrible story. Okay, so back to physics. All right. So, sorry if this story bothers you. It is truly awful story. Yeah, if you ever catch me out somewhere having a beer, don't ask me to start telling you my New York City stories. I'm sure some of you have some too. At any rate, so we're at static equilibrium. So what we want to do is use our two equations. So the first thing to do is to just simply use the sum of the vector forces is zero. It doesn't matter what's happening in this direction, because you just have no forces that way. So you basically have zero is equal to zero. Same is true coming in and out of the board. But all the forces are going up and down. So the first thing you want to do is to make sure that you draw the forces correctly and know what the forces are. So we have one that's shown here, which is normal force. I'll call it N1. Okay. There's another one, which I'll put here, which is N2. And then there's the force of gravity, which is down, which is the mass of the beam times g. Okay? And when we use the linear equation, the sum of the vector forces is equal to zero,
That's really the sum of the forces in the y direction is equal to zero in this problem. And so zero is equal to N1 plus N2 minus Mg. And you can plug in the numbers here. You are given N1. You want to know N2. And in this case, you're given this mass and you know G. So you can actually just use this equation to calculate N2. And when I did that, I got it to be 78.4 newtons. When you plug in the numbers. That might make you feel good, because if this thing has a mass of, has a weight of 117 newtons, and you're only supporting 40 of it over here, you better be supporting the rest over here. Really. So the fact that it's a bigger number than the 40 is good in this case. Then we want to sum the torques equal to zero, so that's the other condition. And then it's natural to ask, okay, I'll sum the torques, but about what axis? So that's the next decision you have to make. And you really have a lot of freedom here. Very often the problem will be just stuff that's set up in such a way that there's a natural axis to choose. Because what you want to do when you sum the torques is to sum forces times lever arms. So you always have to figure out these lever arms. So you want to do that as expeditiously as you can. And in this case, you're basically given this distance. You're given this distance. And this is the distance you want. So it's natural to choose this point right here as the axis, because then the distances are all there. You don't have to think about it. But you can choose to do the axis at some other point if you wish. As long as you do the lever arms right, and everything will be okay. It'll work. So usually there's an appropriate axis. In this case, I'm going to sum the torques about this point. Right there. All right, so now you have to choose what's positive and what's negative. It's not moving, so you don't have the natural direction of motion in the problem to sort of define for you what's positive and negative. So you sort of have to visualize, and in some sense it doesn't really matter. I am going to define, because I just have to put in signs, this direction about that axis to be positive. So if I do that, then we have that zero is equal to 2 meters times N1. Let me not put the unit here so it's not confused with mass. 2 times N1. So that is negative because it's... All right, let me... Zero. The first thing I want to do is make it to put in the torque due to this force. It is going to cause this thing, if it were only force involved, would cause it to flip this way. So it's going to come in as a negative torque, and it will be this force times that distance. So the first force, the first torque is minus 2 times N1. The second piece I'll make from this force. This force would cause it to rotate that way, which I've defined as a positive torque. So it will be plus 5 times mg. And then the last one, there's only one other force, will be N2 times this distance, which is what the problem is defined as x, which is actually what you're after. So this comes in as minus x times N2. N1 we're given, N2 we've just calculated, M we're given, G you know. So you have everything here except x. So you then can solve for x. And in this case, when I solved for x, I got 6.5 meters. So then you ask yourself, at this point, does it make any sense? And
6.5 meters is beyond the halfway point here, which you really sort of need, because if I were to sum torques here, you can't have it spinning about that. So you're over here, but you're further in than 2 meters, because if you were at 2 meters, then you have a symmetry in the problem that the weight borne here and the weight borne here would have to be the same. But you already know the normal forces are very different. So this thing has to be further in because the normal force there is much better. In other words, it's bearing more weight. Yes?
Could we go over the directions again?
Sure. So I define a spin about this point, and then I have to choose directions. So I will choose, if a force causes the beam to rotate this way about that point, I would call positive. This way I'd call it negative. This force causes the beam to rotate like that, so it comes in negative N1 times 2. This one comes in positive because it's causing the rotation and it causes the direction. Okay? You may find a book that actually tries to give you a convention. If you're looking at it from, you know, whatever, down the thing, and it rotates clockwise, you might call it positive, counterclockwise, it might be negative. I don't know, I find that confusing. You just need to choose the convention for whichever problem. Okay? Any other questions about this? Yes?
So you're saying that you could determine like the rotation point, whatever you want, right? Like when you said that, you're talking about why not put it right at the middle and then get rid of...
Well, you can. Okay? And if you put it in the middle, then the lever arm for this one, which would cause it to rotate this way about that point, which... would be, so the torque here would be now N1 times 3. So you have to do a little mental calculation because it's the lever arm from the axis you choose. This one would be N2. It'd be negative because it would cause you to rotate the other way. So remember the picture is I'm rotating at this point. So this would be negative N2 times X minus 5. So you have to think about what it is, because I want this distance. And then this one, the lever arm, is 0, so it doesn't come into the sum. But if you do that, you will get the same answer. It's just in this case, to me, I have to do two little mental calculations if I put this torque here, if I rotate up this axis, and here I don't really have to. But every problem will have its, will often suggest something to you. So long as you're consistent and you get the lever arms right, it doesn't matter. You can pick any axis that works for it. Okay? But do notice that when you choose the axis to be the point where a force acts, if when it's along the line of the force, that lever arm is 0 and that term drops out of the equation. So I think occasionally you'll see a problem where if you choose that point as your axis, you sort of get rid of a force that you might need. Asked to solve for, so you sort of make it so you can't actually solve the problem when you use that particular equation, perhaps.
Usually it comes into the other equation, though, so it turns out. I think it's still soluble, but it can be a bit confusing. Any other questions? Okay. Let's do one that's a little bit subtler. Suppose that we have a uniform ladder leaning up against the wall. And we'll say that it's leaning against a frictionless wall. And the ladder weight is 60 newtons. What is the minimum mu sub s between the ladder and the floor such that the ladder does not slip? So conceptually, this is a very smooth Teflon surface. If this is a very smooth Teflon surface and you try to pop a ladder up, it will just fall. Right? You would never climb a ladder if the floor is too waxed, right? Most of you wouldn't be here if you didn't already basically know that. So you have some roughness on this surface that gives you a frictional force, since basically when you're climbing up here, it's going to want to cause this ladder, this will slip out and the ladder will fall. So you have to have a frictional force here that is pushing back that way in order to stabilize things. And that's the intuition. And I'm asking you, what is the minimum use of S between the ladder and floor, such that that is true? That minimum use of S, I'm asking it in a very special way, because remember that the frictional force, when it is static, can be a maximal value, which is given by the normal force times mu sub S. It can be smaller than that, easily. But in this case, we're asking what is the minimum use of S such that this ladder is failing. So normally when you see a problem that has that sort of weird conditional statement in it, that gives you permission to define the frictional force as mu sub S times N. Okay? Alright. So the first step to solving this problem is to figure out, I probably need to give you some information like the length of the ladder. In this case, we'll say that the length is 5 meters. Okay? So, at the start, in the class last time, we sort of talked about the forces that you want to consider. One is you want to consider the mass of the ladder to be located at its center of mass. It's a uniform ladder, which I didn't write down, but we'll say it's a uniform ladder. So that means that we have the force mg acting here, and by virtue of the length of this thing and the uniformity and what the center of mass represents, I know that that's happening at 2.5 meters up the ladder, because it has to be at the center. I know I will have a normal force here of the floor on the ladder, and the way that this problem is worded, I know that I have friction between the floor and the ladder, and you have to be really careful with friction in some of these problems, because sometimes, depending on what the other forces are doing, the friction may not go quite the direction you think it might. In this case, well, often there's a way to know. So at the moment I know I have to have a force of friction, I'm going to put it over here just so I can remember I have to do something with it. And I'm going to think of another force that I know, which is I know I have the normal force of the wall on the ladder. I'll call this the normal force of the floor on the ladder. Now, aside from friction, there's no other force on this ladder. You're told that it's a frictionless wall, so you know that there's no force of friction here. Okay? You know that there's a force of friction here. How do I know which direction that it points? I hope your intuition says, gee, if I climb this ladder, it's going to slip out that way, so I know that the force of friction has to be pushing to the right. Okay? That's what your intuition should be. But there's another way to know that. How do you know when you look at the forces up here that it has to be to the right? What do you think?
There's no force of pushing.
Exactly. Without doing any calculation, you look at this thing and it cannot be translationally stable if you don't have some force pushing to the right to counterbalance this. And the only force that can be is friction, because there's no other force in this problem. So very often, you can actually determine directions of things with that type of thinking. Okay? So try to bring that to bear. So I know that I have a force of friction going that way. And the direction really is important, because you can't get the torque sign correct if you don't know the direction that things go and the sum of the forces in different, you know. So you have to get the direction correct. All right. Those are all the forces. Now I just use my equations. And in this case, it's a two-dimensional problem because I have forces going both this way and that way. I'll call this x. I'll call this y. I'll call positive x to the right. So the sum of the forces in the x is equal to the force of friction minus the normal force of the wall. The sum of the forces in the y is equal to mg minus nf. So in this case, I've defined y positive going like that, x positive going like that, and I will define this as my positive direction of torque. Just because. Okay? Alright, so these are the translational equations. I haven't pulled out the torque yet. But this will be equal, because of the force of friction, because I'm told I want the minimum force of friction, the minimum mu sub s. I know that the force of friction here is equal to the normal force times mu sub s. So I know that mu sub s times the normal force of the floor minus in wall is equal to zero. And n sub f minus mg is equal to zero. So mg is equal to n sub f. And mg I'm given is 60 newtons. So I know that nf is 60 newtons. But I still don't know that. So now I have, from this equation, I get nf is 60 newtons. I can plug it in here and calculate mu sub s if I have in wall. But I don't have that. I need another equation, and we haven't used the torque equation yet. But I can, just to sort of summarize where I am with these two things, these two equations tell me that 60 times mu sub s minus n wall is equal to zero. So that's the translational information is giving me that. So now I want the sum torques. To sort of think about this one for a moment. So let me clean it up a little bit. I'm going to do torques about the bottom because it seems natural to me for whatever reason. Now, I want you to imagine for a moment summing a torque of end of this force on the wall about an axis which is here at the floor. Okay, so right here. And there are two ways to think about that torque, because remember, torque is equal to the component of the force that is perpendicular to the line joining the axis to where the force is applied. So it is only the perpendicular piece of this that is important. So there are two ways that you can do this. you can imagine that this fourth acts along this line, in which case you can take this distance, where this is at right angles, as your vector r. And if you want to put in this problem the torque around the axis at the bottom of the ladder due to this force, you can take this force and multiply it by this distance. Okay? That's one way to look at it. The other way to look at it would be to use this distance all the way along the ladder. But if you do that, the component of the force that you want to use is the piece that is perpendicular to that. So you want to choose this, which I'll call NW perpendicular if you want. Okay? And this force multiplied by this distance will give you the same force. So you have to somehow project out the perpendicular piece. Very often in the problem, you will be given some information where one of these might be easier than the other. But in principle, you can do them both. They both will require that you actually think for a moment about an angle, which I haven't given you. Or have I? Yeah, I dropped out some of the information. So you're given in this problem that this distance is 4 meters and this distance is 3 meters, and I've already told you that that distance is 5 meters. So it makes a 3-4-5 triangle. Okay, so if you're given that, you now have enough information to get that angle if you need it, which you do. So actually, though, in this case, when I set up the problem and I give you these links, what that's telling you is that I've given you this length already. And that's what I mean by very often one of these two ways will sort of suggest itself as the easiest way to do it. In this case, because I've already given you this length, you can take that length and multiply it by the end of the four. Okay? So I do suggest that you look in these problems each of these ways, because very often one will be easier than the other. If you wanted to do it this way, I'm giving you this length, so you could do it this way, but now you have to calculate the component of the force here, which means you have to use the 3-4-5 triangle and do an angle calculation so that this gets multiplied by a sine or a cosine, and then stop and finish. But, okay. All right, so in this case, I think the one we want to choose is this, because this component's already taken for you. All right. So that said, let's go ahead and do this. So in this problem, I want to do the sum of the torques is equal to zero to be my next equation. And I'm going to do it about this axis. And I have chosen clockwise rotation to be positive. So note that in the torque sum, both of these forces pass through the axis. So I don't put it in the torque sum at all. I have this force and that force going to the torque zone. This one is acting to rotate the bladder into the wall. This one is acting to push it away from the wall. And they have to cancel each other out. That's what it's telling you, because if I put a hinge here, it's not rotating. All right? So here's MG. It's at the center point of this beam, so I know that this line has to pass through the center point of this distance by symmetry. So I know that this force acts, MG acts at 1.5 meters if I want to project out the perpendicular distance. So the positive torque is going to be 0 is equal to mg times 1.5. This distance is 1.5 meters. And the negative torque will be minus nw times 4 meters. Okay? And if you recall from earlier, so now, mg I've got, that's the mass of the ladder times g, times 1.5. nw I do not have. Then I have this equation that we have from the translational piece. I don't have nw, and I don't have u sub s. But now I have two equations and two unknowns. So you can solve for both nw and u sub s. Okay? When I did it, I got u sub s is equal to 3.8. I'm sorry, 3/8. Okay. Any questions on this one? This is a torque sum. Mm-hmm. So the torque sum about this point. So I need to have the perpendicular lever arm to that force, which would be the line that goes from here straight up to the line here.
Okay.
Which is a distance of 4 meters.
Okay, thank you.
It is true that I may have defined y positive this way, but I don't call this a negative 4 and multiply by r, because if I do that, I'm confusing my linear direction sign with my torque sign. And in this case, I'm not looking at translational motion, I'm looking at sense of rotation, and I've defined any torque that makes it rotate this way is negative, and that way is positive. And I only worry about the net length of the lever arm.
Okay, thank you.
That helps. Anything else? Okay, so now I want to do one that has, I guess what I would call a subtle force. So now what we have is a beam, which is this piece, so that's like a long, stiff thing. Alright, and it has a mass of 85 kilograms, and it supports at the very end a rope or something that supports a mass of 430 kilograms. And we're given that this distance to the end here is 2.5 meters. And that this distance is 1.9 meters. This is at right angles. Just looking to see if I have any, if there's any other information we're given. That's what I seem to have written that we have. Okay. So the question is, find the tension in the upper cable.
I'm suspicious that I need to give you this link or something, but I don't have it written down in my notes, so we'll discover that as we go. Okay, so here we go. Now, what are the forces in this problem that I should worry about?
Gravity.
Okay, gravity. Where do I need to worry about gravity at? On the box. Okay. Good. So I know that I have the mass of the box times G here. What else? Gravity acts on this beam. I didn't say it, but it's a uniform beam. I have to tell you something about what's happening right here. This beam has a hole and it's pinned here. So what happens is at this point we have sort of blow it up. We have a piece of metal like this. This piece comes in like so. And there is a metal, there's a hole in the beam, and there's a metal pin that sort of goes through that hole that holds it in place. Okay? And I'm going to ignore this length and that length of the thing. I'm going to sort of assume it attaches to the wall exactly 1.9 meters below that and exactly 2.5 meters from that point. All right. But you told me that gravity acts at the beam, so it'll be at the midpoint. Since I'm given this distance and that distance, I can actually figure out the length because I have a... Actually, I can figure out this length. That's why I'm suspicious. I need to give you something here. So,
I think I'm going to simplify. I think I just have a bad drawing. Don't you wish you could just change the questions on the fly on your exam? I don't like that one, so we're going to do this one instead. That would be totally cool. So I'm going to do this for simplicity. Okay. So what that means is that we can calculate from this and this, we can calculate that length, and we're going to put in G acting at the halfway point. I'll call it M sub B times G for mass of the beam. Okay? What else?
Normal force.
Where?
In the ball of the beam.
And what direction is the normal force going to go?
Perpendicular to the wall to the right.
Perpendicular to the wall to the right. So you're telling me it's going to be like this. Okay. What else? Tension in the cable. There are two cables. So I'm going to call this one a T prime. And I'll call this one a T. And I put it at both ends because it's pulling on both ends. And now what's important is you have to ask yourself which force do I have to worry about. Here, the T is acting both on this beam and on this thing, so we really have to keep the T. You know, we think of this as one free body diagram, and we worry about that. This, I'm not really asking you about what's the tension in the wall, so I don't really have to worry about this, but this one's very important. So that's the tension in the upper cable, which is in fact what you're after. Is there a problem with the forces that we have in the system now? Here's a beam. Think about its translational motion, horizontally. I have a force going to the left, I have a force going to the right. Those can cancel out. Be good. What about up and down? The beam has two forces on it that are down, and it has no force that is up. So something's not quite right. Where are you going to get an upward force? What do you think?
Is there another normal force as it's running straight up?
Yeah. So this is, like I said, this one's solid. Okay. I'll tell you, the thing is pinned and free to rotate. A way to think about that would be what you have, if I blow up that joint, is if you look at the hole in the beam, it's like this. And you have a pin that's sitting in here. So in a sense, you're used to saying, oh, the normal force is always at right angles. But this pin sort of can move in this hole so that normal, this normal force will act depending on exactly where that pin is settled. Okay? Now, maybe I could explain that to you in some problem, but they probably wouldn't. What they would say is it's loose and ready to rotate, and they wouldn't tell you. And the way that you know you have a more complicated normal force is by looking at these forces and realizing, holy crap, it's going to go flying down if I don't have some other force. And the only other way you can do it is to have it be at this joint. Okay, so this pin is sitting there, and basically, it's not just a surface butting up against the wall. It's pinned, which means you can basically have normal force component in any direction, depending on whether I'm pushing on it or pulling on it. So, in this case, we will put it in whatever direction we seem to need. And the truth is, I don't know what direction that is, but I know that it's not constrained to be just out. So this normal force has to have some up and down component. In fact, it has to have some component that's going up because it has to counterbalance these. It also has to have some component going this way because it has to counterbalance that. So what I know is that I have a normal force here that goes out at some angle. And I will call that angle Theta. No, I will not. I am looking at my drawing, and that's not what I wanted to do. I'm going to draw it, I just want to draw it so that I have clarity to draw the angles and separate them. So I'm putting this in, out, and I'm going to call that angle phi, and then we're going to say that this angle is theta. Since I'm given these distances, I can calculate theta. Okay, I can calculate this angle. Phi here is the angle for the normal force. Okay, so there's two angles here. And now we've got all the forces. This normal force has a component that is to the right, which can counterbalance this one. It has a component that is up, which can counterbalance this one and that one, so that translationally this thing could be okay. If I were to think of this as my axis that I rotate about, I have these two forces that want to rotate the thing that way, and I have this force that rotates it that way. So at this point, you can look at it and say, okay, physically perhaps this is now a situation that could work. But you sort of want to go through that process before you just jump into doing a bunch of equations, because you can be happily know that some of the force is zero and some of the torque is all zero. But if you're missing a force, it will never work. So you're going to spend all of your time setting up and trying to solve equations that can't be solved. Okay? So you really do want to take the time and mentally at least do a cross-check to make sure that you have forces that can counterbalance each other in principle, so that you can then set up the equations. All right, so let's just do, we're going to use the mass here, because we're given the information to determine what T prime is. So we're interested in this force, so we're actually going to look at the beam being in static equilibrium. We're going to use this mass, which we also know isn't going anywhere. It's not going to rotate it out of anything, but it is going to pull on this cable. So it determines the tension here. So we have to use that. So we know that the sum of the forces is equal to zero, so that's equal to T1 minus mg. So we get that T1 is equal to mg T prime, sorry. It's equal to 430 times 9.8, whatever it is. Okay? And now we have the beam, like so. Sum of the forces in the x, I'll call x positive this way, it's equal to zero, and that's going to be equal to n times the sine of phi minus t. Right, n times the sine of phi projects out this component of that normal force here. So I have that piece of the normal force and this force are canceling out. So that's what that equation tells you. And then the sum of the forces in the y is equal to zero. I will choose positive to be up in this case. We get the n times the cosine of phi minus mg minus mb times g, because we're summing forces this way, so m cosine phi gives you this component, minus this force, minus that force. And then we have one last piece, which is the torque piece. I'll define positive to be stuff that rotates it like so. So in this case, I will do a sum about this axis. If I do the sum about that axis, the normal force cancels out because the lever arm is zero, so I don't have to worry about it. And so I have this force acting at a distance of 1/2 of 2.5 here because of the symmetry. So 0.5 times 2.5 would be the distance here times mvg. Have a negative torque, which is this tension acting to rotate the beam that way, which is going to be this tension times 1.9 of the lever arm. And then we have this tension that's acting to rotate us clockwise or positive, so I'm going to be plus t prime times 2.5. Alright, so we have one equation, we have two equations, and we have three equations. We don't know either the tension. Oh no, we do know. We use this to get us t prime. So we do know t prime. We don't know t. We're after it, and we don't know n, and we don't know phi. So that's three unknowns. We have three equations. So it's solvable. Okay. So let's look at another example. That might be sort of interesting to some of you, I hope. Let's imagine that we are doing curls with the arm, except we're going to hold a mass and we're just going to hold it out like that. Okay? Then what you can imagine is you can model the arm basically as this, where you now have, you know, some big mass. And so you have this big mass going down. Let's even consider the arms to be massless, although you could consider them as thin beams in the real world, because they do have mass. What gives you the torque going the other way? Right, this is going to rotate you down. So you've got a muscle that comes in here. Which gives you a force here, right? And if we just think about this problem for a moment, this distance I'll call little d, this distance I'll call big D. Sum of the torques equal to zero says that zero is equal to d times big F minus mg times big D, or D times F is equal to mg times D. where that little df is not the differential f, it's the distance b times f. So the reason that I wanted to show you this is that if we were to take a lot of the star athletes in the world and dissect them and measure the distance from this some reasonable point of rotation in the elbow to where the muscle inserts, one of the things that we would find, if we did that to a billion people, we would find that many star athletes would have insertion points that are a tiny bit further out. Because if people will have distribution where those muscles insert a little bit. If that muscle inserts a little bit further out, then for the same force here and the same arm length, they can support a bigger mass because the torques are equal. So just a little something to think about. I know your coaches will always tell you it's all about hard work. So you should just look at them and go, crap. It's easy for him because his insertion points are an inch further out than mine. So, you know, that it isn't just always about hard work. I mean, it is maybe it's sad, maybe it's part of the richness of life, but we're all born different. And that also extends to your ability to do athletic things. And sometimes, yes, you can work very hard and overcome some things, but, you know, some things are easier for some people because of sometimes for very physical reasons like that. So, just thought you might have fun with that. Any questions on this? Okay, so just so you know where we're going, I'm going to skip thermodynamics in this class. We're going to do fluids because I think fluids is more important for you all. Thermodynamics is incredibly important, but I'm assuming you get some of that in your chemistry. Okay? So I'm not going to do thermodynamics. But we're going to go to fluids next, and then after that we'll move to waves. But for right now, I want to hand back your exams. The distribution in two different bin sizes looks like so. The mean is about 65, but you see it's very asymmetric, so the median is probably a better measure. The median is about 68, okay? So that's about right here, but it's quite asymmetric. And I think probably I've said enough about what you should think about it, but obviously if you have questions, you ask me. Solutions are already on the web. The grades are in Blackboard, but I haven't yet. I'll turn on the column so you can see it. I didn't do that yet.